You're listening to episode 345 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hello, Max. How are you?
Doing well, David. Getting ready to head out on a road trip and do some camping and enjoy the crisp fall air, I think.
Yeah, it's been kind of nice here on the East Coast, at least for the last couple of days. We've had almost seasonably fall weather, which is nice. But our thoughts do go out to everybody on the West Coast who are dealing with all of that other stuff, and our South Coast that are dealing with hurricanes. So we're kind of getting the best of it right now, but we do understand that there's a lot of people out there we're sending thoughts to. So, but we got a show tonight, Max, with lots of stuff. I loaded up the list. I'm sorry.
Yes, you did. What have you got for us, David?
We got a loyal wingman revs its engine. A drone crashes into a wind turbine. I thought that was kind of funny that a drone crashed into a propeller.
I didn't even think of it that way.
China is down, or are they? And drone makers see an opportunity. Underwater rubbish collection drones for marine animal rescues, photographing the orange landscapes caused by wildfire smoke, and harassing a police officer with a drone. So with that, Max, we should get started.
All right, David, let's get started.
Our first story comes from intelligentaerospace.com. Loyal Wingman combat drone powers up its engine for the first time. Boeing's Australia Loyal Wingman aircraft that was rolled out in May has had its first engine run. So we're getting really close to first flight.
We are. And Boeing keeps saying that that first test flight is to come sometime later this year in 2020. And there isn't a whole lot of 2020 left. We'll see if they make that commitment. We've been calling it the Loyal Wingman, and it is, but it's also known as the Air Power Teaming System, the ATS. And as you said, David, they fired up the engine on the first aircraft, but they haven't said yet just exactly what engine is in that aircraft.
And that bothers you to no end, doesn't it? That you, the engineer, that bothers you no end that you don't know who's powering it up.
I know. And it also cost me about 45 minutes today trying to research because apparently there...
It's classified?
Well, there's some buzz that it's a business jet turbofan derivative, which would make sense, that provides about 8,000 pounds of thrust. So I spent the afternoon trying to see if I could figure out what engine that might be. And, you look at the bizjet engines, and most of them are below that or above that. A lot of them are above that. One possibility is the Pratt & Whitney Canada PW300 turbofan, because, I mean, there are a range of models. The highest thrust version of the PW300 produces around, guess what? 8,000 pounds of thrust. So, you know, maybe that's it. I don't know. I'm just guessing.
I guess, Max, the question would be, how is it to take a civilian off-the-shelf bizjet engine and then modify it for military use? I know that they flow, ebb and flow from each other back and forth, but is it easy to take an off-the-shelf engine and make it a military derivative?
Basically, yes, in most cases. You know, unless you've got an aircraft that's got some really unusual characteristics, it can be relatively straightforward. I mean, I think, you know, they'd look around and say, okay, what's the thrust requirement for this Loyal Wingman aircraft? What are the dimensions of the aircraft? So what are the constraints in terms of engine size? You know, what kind of performance are they looking for? And then just looking around and saying, well, you know, if there's an existing engine, especially when we're dealing with prototypes, if there's an existing engine that can be easily adapted, let's do that rather than spend a couple of billion dollars designing a new engine. Whether the engine that's being used now will be the engine used long term in a production kind of environment for this Loyal Wingman aircraft. Don't know. But it does drive me crazy. I need to find out what engine this is.
I don't think I didn't notice that the first engine, the engine that you landed upon happened to be a Pratt Whitney one. I did notice that.
Well, I actually started looking at GE engines first because a lot of times for military aircraft, it seems like the military fishes around with GE first and in many cases.
But keep in mind, Max, also that this is an Australian project. Is there any international engines? Would there be a Rolls Royce? We're so used to talking about engines here in the States. I'm wondering if there would be a regionally accessible business jet engine for Australia.
Yeah, there could be, but they're probably looking ahead towards volume production in the United States. Ultimately, I would imagine. You know, what are the export requirements and all of that? So, it's an open question right now. But hopefully we'll know soon, and hopefully we'll see first test flight in the next few months.
So the next story is a quadcopter losing a battle to a very large propeller. Drone crashes into wind turbine in, quote, extremely rare, unquote, incident. This was from bristolpost.co.uk. Earlier this year, a Phantom 4 crashed into one of four wind turbines at a sewage treatment plant. Ouch.
Yeah. They were using the Phantom to survey this sewage treatment works. It's the Bristol Sewage Treatment Works in Avonmouth. As you might suspect, the wind turbine was undamaged. I'm not sure what the Phantom looked like after it encountered this, but the details of this are kind of interesting. And what this article is reporting on is the Air Accidents Investigation Branch report, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Now, according to the report, the pilot was using the NATS Drone Assist App 1 as part of the flight planning and risk assessment for the flight. All right, that's good. However, apparently the app didn't mention these wind turbines. So what did the pilot do? He Googled it. Well, he looked it up on the internet. He looked up wind turbine height and came back with 328 feet. So he figured that if he could fly at his maximum allowable altitude of 400 feet, then he'd clear the wind turbines. Well, it turns out that the turbines are 413 feet above ground. So calculation didn't work.
He tried. I got to give the guy credit. He at least, part of this was, I thought, well, you know what? I don't blame the guy because he didn't have the information and he was smart enough to look it up.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a really good risk mitigation. You know, I don't really know the answer to this, but okay, I'm going to look it up. Unfortunately, it still was the wrong answer, but I wouldn't associate wind turbines with sewage treatment plants personally. So it was sort of like, at least he knew what the environment he was flying in.
Yeah.
What surprised me was also, we found out an article was, this was from powerengineeringint.com, how drones can make inspections smart and automated for utilities. According to Power Engineering International, since COVID-19 pandemic, power companies are turning to drones for inspections. And here we have, yes, it's great. Let's go use them, but just be careful for the wind turbines.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. This Power Engineering piece really spends a lot of time talking about the recently unveiled DJI Matrice 300 RTK, which, of course, is a commercial drone platform. It's a pretty good sized quadcopter with a 55 or up to 55 minute flight time. But it's it's one of the breed of commercial drone platforms that allow you to put some pretty significant sensor arrays on, depending on what your applications are, And, you know, for these kinds of inspections, it's a good option. But they're not inexpensive, but this is commercial grade stuff.
Well, 9K is minimum, you know, and it, but these are top of the line tools for what they're needed for, which I kind of like the way this has been working out, because this flows into our next article. We were talking about the Matrice, but evidently from scnow.com, drone maker hurt by U.S.-China rift opening its door to U.S. rivals. DJI seems to be taking a bit of a hit because of their, we're not sure if it's true or not, data transmissions to the Chinese government.
Yeah, and yeah, this may be, and we've said this before, caught up in you know, the
politics.
So it's hard to say. DJI, of course, claims or continues to say that these drones don't represent a security risk and all of that. But nevertheless, governments are banning Chinese drones. And what the article is showing is that for other drone makers, not Chinese drone makers, that maybe this is an opportunity to step in and try to grab some business. So we see things, some strange things. We see things like from Parrot, the French drone maker. They've actually advertised the words, "Don't trust Chinese drones," which is, that's a pretty extreme
that's
statement.
That's definitely target marketing.
It really is. Also, what's going on is some U.S. drone companies are targeting their products to government agencies, right? They're saying, all right, so if some agencies are restricted from purchasing Chinese drones, then what do these agencies need? And can we, you know, package up our offering to be attractive to these government agencies?
Skydio hired a retired police captain to pitch its drones to law enforcement, which is interesting. You know, that way you've got someone who's knows how to speak the language of the manufacturer of the drone and the target audience, which is always good. And with that, also our Department of Defense here in Pennsylvania here, our Department of Defense here in the United States approved Parrot, Skydio, and three others to supply U.S. manufactured drones to federal government agencies. This after they had banned DJI due to the security risk. DJI struggles to counter the security's threat perception. They announced an internet kill switch on war drones that stops data transmission on sensitive flying missions. So they really are trying to answer the calls, but there's a lot of noise out there about their role. And I think part of this is that they had gotten so big so fast and were so dominant that everybody else is sort of looking around and go, and unfortunately there was a weakness found, you know, and so everybody's using that advantage to DJI, right or wrong.
It's kind of a public relations issue for them, but as you said, David, it's also a big political issue that's not entirely under their control.
So, but at least they're not underwater, unlike our next story, which is from springwise.com. Autonomous drones and vehicles collect rubbish from the ocean floor. I kind of like this. Little baby subs going along, picking up trash.
Yeah, it needs to be done. There is a lot of trash in the oceans. We see that a lot, plastic and a lot of other things as well. And how much of it is out there? Well, there's one estimate that puts it between 26 to 66 million tons of waste in the ocean. And 94% of that is on the seafloor. So we have a European Union-funded project called Sea Clear, and they want to clean up this mess.
And what's under this project? An unmanned surface vessel acts as a mothership. Tethered to it are drones and remotely operated vehicles, ROVs, and they will use AI-based algorithms to map, identify, and classify the rubbish. And a combined suction gripper manipulator will collect it. Now, that sounds like something out of the Batcave. A suction gripper manipulator, bat sucker. I don't know, but We've talked about ROVs and we've talked about AI. This is another use where I know it's the unmanned aerial vehicle podcast that we talk about, but this is a really good use for drones. And UAVs fly in fluid, so do USVs. So what else, Max?
The remote operated vehicles, the underwater drones, if you will, are tethered to that mothership, and that's where they get their power from. But also the mothership provides the necessary compute power for the drones. That's an interesting concept that, you know, might have applications in other kinds of swarms, maybe that aren't tethered, for example. But another part of this is that SeaClear is looking for a completely autonomous solution. They're looking for a situation where the ship is autonomous, the underwater machines are autonomous, and I guess this thing could just sort of, you know, scour around the ocean collecting stuff. Now, they say that when this is operational, they'll be able to detect and classify underwater litter with an 80% success rate, that they'll be able to collect it with a 90% success rate, and all costing 70% less than using divers to collect this stuff.
I mean, this is pretty awesome. I mean, those are amazing stats. Classifying it with 80%, I mean, occasionally you're going to get a shrimp that's getting sucked up, but for all intents and purposes, they're going to get all the trash. And given the fact that a lot of it is microplastics, you know, tiny little particles, an 80% success rate and a 90% collection rate is pretty awesome considering what the kind of particulates they're going to be scooping up off the floor is. They've done prototype tests in the port of Hamburg along the coast of Dubrovnik, Croatia. So they're actively growing this. So I kind of look forward to seeing, like, there'll be lots of little probes scouring the globe to suck up the variety of trash, to paraphrase television in the 70s. But, Max, we always like acronyms. And SeaClear, believe it or not, is one. You want to clarify?
It's kind of forced, isn't it? For one thing, SeaClear is a great name for this, right? Given what the mission is. So this comes from Search, Identification, and Collection of Marine Litter with Autonomous Robots. So you get the SE from Search. You get the A from the middle of Identification. That's kind of cheating a little bit, I think. C is the Collection of Marine Litter, L with AR, autonomous robot. So that's where you get SeaClear. But we'll have a link to the website for that in the show notes. The EU is contributing just a little under 5 million euros for this project, and it's being coordinated by Delft University in the Netherlands.
Hey, let's hear it for the Dutch. Dutch.
Delft seems to be coming up a lot lately with some of the stories we've been reporting in either here or over at Airplane Geeks podcast.
And a lot of it has to do with AI. And that's where this is going to be. But we like these kind of stories. And, you know, when we're talking about the ocean floor and trash, maybe we need to talk about marine animal research and conservation. This was from Verizon.com about using drones to support maritime animal rescue and conservation. Sometimes animals become distressed, tangled in a net, tangled in some sort of plastic floating around the oceans. Please, folks, if you get a six-pack, cut open your carrier things, or they might just not feel good for the day.
So, as you might imagine, drones can provide an assist with this, but in this article, in an interesting way, and what they're talking about is using drones to go out and assess the situation first. You see, if a marine biologist or somebody else is going to go out there to try to provide some assistance to the animal, what they need to take with them is dependent on what the situation is out there. And so the idea here is that drones can go out and assess that situation so that those coming to help can bring the equipment they need to help the animal.
Isn't that called triaging the patient?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Now, an issue associated with that, if you're going to do that, you want to make sure that the drone that's gone out there to do that triage...
Do no harm.
It doesn't cause the animal to experience additional stress. So the question is, and this comes from a marine biologist, Jenny Brookshire, who happens to be a FAA-certified drone pilot, is how do you tell which drone or how much noise is not going to scare the animal? And it turns out that there's not a lot of research in that area. So Jenny Brookshire partnered up with Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, looking to see the pitch and volume levels that cause the least stress to marine animals. And what they did is they recorded the noise from 10 drones, and they selected four of those 10 that were best suited to this kind of use for drones. They went to the water off Washington State. And here's where Verizon comes in, because this is actually a Verizon article. They manage the flights with Verizon's Skyward drone management platform. That's what we talked about last time. So they learned some things about these drones.
They learned how to operate around animals, which flight altitudes and angles help them remain undetected, which I thought was really cool. And then which drones operated quietly enough and demonstrated that stealth propellers can reduce the drone noise footprint. So in a way, to quote Star Trek, we're trying to do that rule of, you know, don't get noticed, just observe, don't make a difference unless you absolutely have to. And they plan to publish their findings in a peer-reviewed journal to make the information available for free on CITO Marine Research's website. So hopefully maybe we can use our Verizon contacts to get a hold of Jenny. I'd like to have a conversation with her about this even more so.
Yeah.
Prime directive, folks, you know, don't interfere if you don't have to. The next one, Max, is pretty self-explanatory, but, you know, if you want to look like what, want to see what San Francisco looks like on Mars, these are the videos for it, which is the sky is on fire in San Francisco, and we flew a drone through it. And this was from TheVerge.com. What'd you think?
Yeah, this is kind of a, like a photo essay. Now, as we all know, drones have provided really unique perspectives of a lot of things, that being from up above. And we've seen some amazing photographs. We've seen some amazing videos of things. Sometimes they're just common things that look really fascinating when viewed from above. Other times they're perspectives that you could only get from up above. So the video director at The Verge took these photographs of San Francisco and the Sutro Tower just after sunrise using a drone. And it's another example, to me, it's another example of kind of art almost. You know, here's this situation where everything is bathed in orange because of the smoke from the wildfires. And it created some really spectacular images.
Beautiful. I mean, they really are. Some of them are just absolutely stunning. That we're not dismissing the unfortunate circumstances that caused it, but these are someone making beauty out of a bad situation, in this case, just using drones. So definitely go to the show notes for this episode, which is theuavdigest.com/345, and look at this article and check out these because they are really beautiful photographs. Well, Max, we haven't had one of these in a long time. So to make up for it, for this year grounded file, we've got a guy that's been caught doing it 13 times.
That's right. He's been flying drones over private property. This is in Ontario. He's got these 13 citations for flying a drone in a harassing manner over residential areas. And he's been doing this for a couple of months. This is... has been ongoing. 13, that's just the number of times he's been cited for doing this. I guess it's possible that he's done a lot more of this, but these are apparently Class B violations. So they're not serious, but their violations under ORS 837.370, and that's for operating a drone over privately owned premises in a manner that, quote, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly harass or annoy the owner or occupant of those premises.
Yeah, one spot he frequented included the home of an Ontario police officer who reported to a sheriff's deputy that he had seen the drone stationary in the air about 25 yards off the ground over his yard about four times. His wife had seen it stationary out a window in a room she normally dresses in. There's a bad sign.
Yeah.
So the person who's allegedly doing this is scheduled for an October 7th court appearance. But as my co-host wrote, but wait, there's more.
Yeah. I don't know how to read this. Well, I know how to read it, but I guess maybe in Canada, the rules are a little bit different, or maybe a lot different.
Well, according to Malheur County District Attorney David Goldthorpe, if a person felt harassed or threatened by something they couldn't actually give chase to, in addition to reporting it to law enforcement officials, they could try and stop it on their own. Now, this sort of sounds like my little Lego set with the net that you fire at the drone to take it out of the sky. If it's over your private property illegally, I can't see a crime where they can't do something to take it down, he said. However, as the drone was being used outside and inside city limits, he said a person in town would have to get sophisticated, quote unquote, about bringing it down. For example, a person in city limits couldn't use a gun to bring it down or any air gun or spring-propelled weapon such as BB or pellet guns, Goldthorpe said. So, Max, I came out of that with the fact that I was going to find it and try to throw a blanket on top of it.
Yeah, but what's being said here by a district attorney in Canada is it's okay to shoot down a drone. So,
Not within city limits.
Well, you can't use a device within city limits that you're not allowed to discharge in city limits. But this is a completely different situation than in the United States, where, as we all know, a drone is classified as an aircraft, and you cannot take down an aircraft. So I don't know. Does this mean that Canada is different? That they're not operating under that sort of basic restriction? Because this district attorney is saying that you can take down a drone if it's flying over your property. I'm just uncertain about this. So maybe we need to find out from some of our Canadian listeners just exactly how this is viewed legally in Canada.
You realize this was Ontario, Oregon, right?
Don't tell me that. No, it's not Ontario, Oregon. Is it? No.
Malheur County is a county in Oregon.
I thought this was Ontario, Canada.
No.
Well, then this guy is nuts. How can a district attorney not know that you can't take down a drone?
Well, okay, folks, just so you know, Malheur County is a county in Oregon. Malheur County is a county in the southeast corner of the U.S. state of Oregon. As of the 2010 census, the population was 31,313. Its county seat is Vail, and its largest city is Ontario. The county was named after the Malheur River, which runs through the county. The word Malheur is French for misfortune or tragedy. So there you go, Max. It was your misfortune that you didn't know.
What a tragedy. I'm going to have to write a letter. Someone's got to straighten this guy out. All right.
See, folks, we do make mistakes, but we try to, I thought it was, to be honest, Ontario, California. And when you started saying Canada, and I'm going, well, no, okay, there are no counties in Canada. There are only provinces and districts. So I was like, okay, maybe he knows something I don't know. And I have family that live in Ontario, so I'm just confused. But yes, it's Ontario or Oregon, and we need to get a hold of the district attorney to say that, it's a federal offense to take out an aircraft.
All right, let's move on. Oh boy, a video of the week, David. You found a video of the week.
I did, and it's kind of bizarre, but
it's quite bizarre.
Actually, it's two. Evidently, there's an abandoned dinosaur park, not quite Jurassic Park, but evidently in Arkansas, that they've shot these videos over this abandoned, looks like drive-through safari park with all these fake dinosaurs and stuff. There's a really nice Stegosaurus, which has always been my favorite, hovering near the water. But it's also got a really nice, relaxing, melodic jazz soundtrack that just sort of calms your breath and calms your heart, you know, as you watch these really nice footage of, even if you don't pay attention to the dinos, the scenery that these drones captured is really pretty.
But it's the background music that's maybe the best of all.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely the background music that just sort of, even if you don't watch the video, close your eyes and just listen to the background music.
Yeah, it's good. All right. Well, that's it. Before I rush off to write my letter to Ontario, there's too many Ontario.
The city of Ontario in Malhern County, Oregon.
Well, oh boy.
That's okay. They're on fire, so you can take your time. I'm sure the letters won't be getting there anytime soon.
Yeah. Oh, it's tragic. Okay. Thank you for listening to the UAV Digest. This has been episode 345. So you can find our website at uavdigest.com. Or if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode and you can read about Ontario's, you can go to the uavdigest.com/345.
Yes, folks, it's good that we can laugh at each other. And of course, you can find us laughing all week long on our Slack listener team. And you do that by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com, and we'll send you an invite. You can also find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook, facebook.com/UAV Digest. But most of all, thank you for listening. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max, not in Ontario.
Soon to be in Vermont.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for listening. Stay safe out there and keep in touch.